Republicans say it will rev up Iowa's economy. Democrats say it could bankrupt the state. Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, IPR's Joyce Russell tells us about the GOP's plan for the largest tax cut package in Iowa history. Also, we'll find out from Amy Mayer about a meeting this week between Joni Ernst, Chuck Grassley, and the president. Also, reporter Lynn Taw on the more than a dozen copycat threats at Iowa schools since that horrible Florida shooting. Kyle Munson and the Des Moines Register will be along. Also, IPR's Tony Daner with headliners of this summer's 8035 Festival and plenty more. First, this news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. So much to come this hour. You'll want to stay around for the entire hour. In a few minutes, I'll talk with IPR's Amy Mayer about a meeting that our senators, Joni Ernst and Chuck Grassley, had with the president this week about the renewable fuel standard. Also, later in the hour, Kyle Munson of the Des Moines Register, his thoughts on all these rankings and lists featuring Iowa and Iowa cities. What else? We'll talk with another Des Moines Register reporter, Lynn Taw, about the more than dozen copycat threats at Iowa schools since that horrible Florida shooting. But let's start off with IPR's Joyce Russell, the State House correspondent. Hi, Joyce.
Hello.
So let's talk. We've been hearing a lot in your reporting about the tax cuts that the Republicans are proposing. Give us an update.
Well, there are sort of two dueling bills out there right now. The Senate passed their very large tax cut, $1 billion a year tax cut, after completely a partisan debate, a lengthy debate on Wednesday night. We should point, you know, should say right away, this is not likely to become law. Would take, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars out of the state treasury, and Democrats argued very strenuously that other state services would inevitably suffer. So that's the Senate's approach, has the backing of most conservative groups, many conservative groups. But the House is working on a far less extensive tax cut plan that was initiated by the governor. Would be put into effect more slowly and would not cut taxes nearly as much, would not address corporate taxes. There's still plenty in there for Democrats to be concerned about taking that much money out of the state treasury and how other services might or how state services would suffer. But a key part of that bill is it has a trigger in it so that unless state revenues are coming in at a good enough clip, these tax cuts would not go into effect. And so The difference between the debate Wednesday night in the Senate and then discussion on the governor's plan in the House on Thursday was pretty much night and day. Mm-hmm. It was a far, far more bipartisan feel to the governor's plan. But it's going to be somewhere in between those two.
Okay, so we can say with all probability there will be a significant tax cut, but perhaps not what the Senate has proposed, which is over $1 billion annually, right?
That's right. And even as we're talking about these two plans out there, the House GOP leadership is just not— they're just not really promoting even the governor's plan. But there is a lot of interest in it. I don't think I'm going out on too far a limb to say that they are going to pass some kind of tax cut bill.
Okay, we'll watch this and listen to your reporting, Joyce. Let's talk about how Iowa's low ranking among states for services for the mentally ill is being addressed by our lawmakers.
You know, that the mental health care has really gotten a lot of attention just in recent months. There have been some high-profile suicides. And just over time, the drumbeat for this has risen. And they do have a pretty comprehensive bill out there now that has passed the House. It's being considered in the Senate. It comes from a working group that the Department of Human Services put together. And basically, it aims to fill in the gaps for mental health care across the state. There is already, they've already done a lot of work on this over the last several years. The health, mental health care delivery system is now divided into regions. So every region is under certain requirements for what they have to offer. And this bill would just add more services that they would have to offer, particularly a crisis intervention for the mentally ill that falls short of the need for hospitalization.
Mm-hmm.
So the governor even mentioned this in her condition of the state speech. And the mental health folks came to the Capitol the day after this passed the House. They were enthusiastic about this bill, optimistic that it will make a difference.
Mm-hmm. And so it sounds like stakeholders, those who work in the field, as well as Iowa families, this affects. Everybody seems to be fairly happy.
Well, they're optimistic about this bill and the good that it can do.
Okay. Talk about kids' mental health care in Iowa specifically and what lawmakers have been doing there.
Well, you know, the system that I just described to you where the state is divided into regions and each of these regions has certain requirements that they have to meet for mental health care, that system does not cover kids. It's kind of hard to understand how things evolved in that way.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a sort of a separate effort to address that issue. Another working group, they came to the Capitol this week and reported on they've got some recommendations out there for something similar to this adult system that's in place. They say we need a system for kids. Very interesting testimony at that hearing, particularly about psychiatric services for children. Some sort of heartbreaking stuff about kids. There aren't enough child psychiatrists, so primary care physicians or others will prescribe psychotropic drugs to kids, and then there aren't enough psychiatrists to oversee that. It sounds like a very bad situation.
Yeah.
The other really interesting thing, though, was that there is telemedicine for child psychiatry. And there was a psychiatrist from the University of Iowa, very interesting testimony that she gave, and how this is, you know, this is filling in some of the gaps, showed a map of the various places around the state where kids can get psychiatric care delivered out of Iowa City.
Interesting.
And she even talked about how in some ways, this really works for kids. She said kids are used to looking at screens. And she said for some mental illnesses, the distance that a screen gives actually works to the kid's benefit. They're also very careful to point out, though, that we need more child psychiatrists.
Right. In the reporting, it was amazing to see a representative of NAMI of Greater Des Moines say there needs to be some awareness raising. I think that the quote there, she had been told by some legislators they don't believe children have mental illness.
Well, that's what she said. She's a very – this is Teresa Baumhoff. She's a very very strong advocate for the mentally ill, and she's been an advocate for this for a long time. She really tells it like it is when she comes before lawmakers. And she said that we need a separate this is not going to happen, but she said we need a separate funding source. We need to raise sales taxes
mm-hmm.
to improve mental health care, especially for children.
Okay, mental health care on lawmakers' minds being debated. Some optimistic views being reported by Joyce Russell. We'll keep our ears to your reporting, Joyce Russell, and we'll get back together on Monday for our legislative Monday in the coming week. I look forward to that.
Okay, thanks, Ben.
Thanks. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Quick conversations to end the week to update news or get to news that we didn't otherwise talk about during our talk shows here on IPR this week. Well, this week, you heard in the news perhaps four Republican senators met with the president, President Trump, to discuss the Renewable Fuel Standard, also goes by the acronym RFS. Iowa's Joni Ernst, Chuck Grassley, we're there along with Ted Cruz of Texas, Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania. Joining us now, Amy Mayer of Iowa Public Radio and Harvest Public Media. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Ben.
So tell us a little bit about this meeting. Interesting. What did they discuss? The renewable fuel standard? But it's interesting. You have oil states and corn states.
It's something that Texas Senator Ted Cruz has been advocating for a long time. He would like to see some changes to the RFS and the Corn State lawmakers, in particular Joni Ernst and Chuck Grassley, but also their colleagues from our neighboring states, would like the RFS to stay the way it is. And with Cruz's persistence, he ultimately secured this meeting with the president.
Mm-hmm. And remind us, the RFS tells how much of these ethanol fuels, for instance, renewable fuels made from corn and so forth, have to be in the nation's fuels for cars and trucks.
Exactly. It sets these levels. They're renewed every year. The volumes, the people who actually mix the fuels are the ones responsible for ensuring that the right amount of renewable fuel is in there. Those are typically the oil refiners. And for Texas Senator Ted Cruz, who represents a state with lots of oil and refineries, mm-hmm. The RFS is considered an onerous law. He would like to see it be, in his eyes, less of a burden on refineries.
Mm-hmm. So did we get any sense of what happened during this meeting, if the president was swayed one way or another?
Well, both Joni Ernst and Chuck Grassley told us later on that day that at the end of the meeting, the status quo had not changed. What had emerged is that President Trump requested a meeting with ethanol industry leaders and oil industry leaders. I believe that took place yesterday. And Grassley and Ernst were reluctant to say that they felt reassured that the president still would stand completely behind the RFS, but that has been his stated stance. Mm-hmm. And also in sort of support of corn growers and others in this region, Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue was quoted this week after that meeting restating his commitment to the RFS.
Mm-hmm. A couple of other items you reported on this week, Amy. The U.S. Senate confirmed the nomination of Iowa Secretary of Agriculture Bill Northey to a USDA position. What is that position?
Well, he will be overseeing the Farm Service Agency, the Natural Resources Conservation Service, and the Risk Management Agency. So basically, those are all farmer-facing agencies, so to speak. He'll be working on customer service to farmers regarding farm program payments, for example. That's FSA, among other things. The Conservation Service offers a lot of technical support and research for farmers who are determining what conservation practices they want to try or expand or so forth. There's also some cost-sharing money that is put through and the Natural Resource Conservation Service.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Risk Management Agency is the one that has the ties, manages crop insurance. So these are all programs that are vital to most Iowa farmers.
And Texas Senator Ted Cruz pops up in this as well. He didn't want Northey.
Well, it's interesting. It is not a coincidence that Northey was confirmed on the same day that the senators met with President Trump.
Mm.
I don't think that Ted Cruz has had any particular objection to Bill Northey for this particular post. It was more that Cruz felt that by preventing a vote on Northey's nomination, Cruz thought he might be able to have some leverage with these conversations he wanted about the RFS. He had been seeking some kind of meeting for months, and Senator Grassley said that there were staff-to-staff level meetings, and Joni Ernst said that Cruz kept moving the goalpost further out, like it wasn't good enough to meet with the president's staff. He wanted to actually meet with President Trump. Well, they met with President Trump, and even though Cruz didn't get what he was arguing for after that meeting, he stopped objecting to the vote, and the Senate swiftly confirmed Northey.
Hmm. Okay. I'm interested in the title of your online report that our listeners can go to. It's an eyebrow-raising headline. You put that together. Eggs, milk, semen, the grocery list of hog genetics. Now, who doesn't want to read about that? You have to find out. So tell us how this story, and I'll just say hatched. Sorry.
Well done. Well, a friend of mine was at a Hy-Vee grocery store in Ames a couple months ago, and it was early in the day on a weekday, and the guy behind her just put 40 dozen eggs on the conveyor to be checked out.
Say again, how many eggs?
40 dozen.
40 dozen eggs on
right.
the conveyor belt.
Yes. And so my friend, who actually raises chickens and likes eggs, turned to this person and said, "What are you going to do with all those eggs?" And then she later posted on Facebook his answer because she found it so startling. And what he'd said to her was, "We use it to stabilize boar semen so we can ship it to Asia."
Stabilize boar semen on its way to Asia. So, and you found out how that works.
I had to go find that out, right? I mean, how could I let that
wouldn't?
Pass me?
Who wouldn't?
Right.
Right.
So there's a company in Cambridge, Iowa called Swine Genetics International, and they were very cagey about just what they use, how they use those eggs and why they buy them at the grocery store. But boar semen is a very large market, and most farmers, for example, in Iowa, they're going to buy it delivered fresh, not frozen. But that's a very short window that the companies have for delivery. But boar semen is more difficult to freeze than, for example, cattle or bovine semen.
Mm-hmm.
So eggs have historically been used as one of the ingredients in these formulas for extenders, which help to preserve the semen and dilute it. So in order to ship it long distances, Swine Genetics International has developed its own proprietary formula, and they have a way to freeze it, ship it with liquid nitrogen tanks, and it arrives in myriad countries around the world where they can then thaw it back out and use it to reproduce pigs.
What a wonderful storyline to pursue. And you've reported on agriculture so long. I imagine there were a number of surprises here for you.
Yeah, although it was actually pretty basic mammalian biology that I found myself immersed in.
Okay. Well, think about that next time I see someone behind me or in front of me at the checkout with 40 dozen eggs.
If you see that in Iowa City, I'll definitely want to know.
Okay. We'll keep you updated. Maybe our listeners will, too. Tell Amy Mayer if somebody's buying a lot of eggs. Amy, thank you so much. And you can check out that and Amy's other reporting at iowapublicradio.org. That article, Eggs, Milk, Semen, The Grocery List of Hog Genetics. Amy Mayer, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, it's not news that the Russians have been hard at work disrupting our politics, trying to sway U.S. public opinion, trying to make our politics even more divisive. What is news, as far as I'm concerned, Russia is also trying to influence America's attitudes about genetically engineered crops and biotechnology, GMOs. That's according to some new research out of Iowa State University. Joining us to talk about it is the researcher who led this, Sean Dorius, assistant professor of sociology at Iowa State. Also, Carolyn Lawrence Dill, associate professor of genetics, development, cell biology, agronomy, chair of bioinformatics and computational biology at ISU. Carolyn and Sean, welcome to our program.
Hi.
Hi.
Great to be here.
Wonderful to have you with us. So who wants to start off? What is going on here?
Well, happy to take a stab at this. We've been looking at doing some research on attitudes about genetically modified organisms, trying to measure public opinion in some novel ways and see if we can't learn a few new things about where these attitudes come from and why they change.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been comparing information on surveys with information that we can glean from social media and online discourse. And along the way, we discovered a signal in the data that seemed to suggest that Russia was also talking about these same topics in fairly systematic ways.
Okay, so you use this term signal in the data. What? Maybe that's a technical thing, but what is a signal in the data in this case?
Well, what got us looking at this is some of the research that's been done on a Russia influence campaign is focused on the idea that Russia cues in on hot button issues that elicit strong emotional reactions, that divide the electorate, that motivate people to action. And in that research, there's some suggestion that GMOs may have been one of those things that was picked up in the campaign. We were already looking at GMOs. And so we kind of cued in on that. And our expectation was that according to some of the other research, is these wedge issues, is Russia often takes both sides of the position. It pushes, say, in this case, a pro-GMO ideology and messaging to one group and an anti to another to further kind of polarize. So those are the kinds of things we were looking for. When we started analyzing Russia's messaging, looking at news coverage, we didn't find a two-sided messaging. We found a fairly consistent negative portrayal. So mm-hmm. in that respect, it stands out as different from what we were expecting and what's been coming from previous research.
Mm-hmm. And remind us, so a lot of Iowa's farmers produce GMO crops, right? Corn, soybeans?
Well, that's true, but I would say that, in fact, this term that we're using, that's GMOs, it really is a term that's outside of the sciences. If you ask a scientist whether we study GMOs, we don't. We study genetics or genetic engineering, crop improvement, as you're referring to, and molecular mechanisms. This term that's GMOs, it's used by the public, and it's a Big Ten or an umbrella term.
Mm-hmm.
It encompasses biotech and bioengineering, of course, but also big business and chemicals and agriculture, industrial agriculture and non-natural processes and food products. So it's this thing that brings together a lot of ideas in people's heads. And because it has a single term that holds it together, it's something that has really entered into public discourse.
Mm-hmm. So you see this signal in the data that the Russians here, too, are trying to divide us even more than we are divided, just accentuate the negative, I guess, might be a way of putting it. How much do we know from what you've looked at, how much influence the Russians are having in our opinions, our feelings about this technology, genetically engineered food and so forth?
We can't answer that question with the data we've looked at so far, the data we've collected. It's certainly on our agenda to try to better understand what kind of influence, if any, that messaging campaign may have had. We've, at this point, we've just seen that these topics do come up in Russian discourse. We're looking at a data set now, some Twitter data that was produced and made public by NBC of some suspected or known Russian bots. And we've been looking at that data, for example, and the same kind of concepts come up there. GMOs comes up as a term in that data set. Mm-hmm. So it does get picked up in that larger messaging campaign.
So give me the experience here. So I sit down at my computer. For whatever reason, I'm reading an article about GMOs, something related to that. How can Russian influence the way I feel about GMOs just by my own clicking?
Some of that depends. Some of the answer to that depends on what your pre-existing positions are, your beliefs about GMOs, your attitudes toward GMOs, and the things related to it. If you have no opinion, no knowledge, it may have little to no influence. If you have strong opinions, it may reinforce those one way or the other. So a lot of that, the answer to that question depends on where you're already at, whether this can reinforce or challenge your existing belief sets. The stronger or more deeply held those pre-existing belief sets, the more likely it is to amplify it if it agrees with it, and the less likely it is to affect it if it disagrees. It wouldn't be incorporated into your belief system.
Mm-hmm. We have a little bit over a minute. So what are your takeaways, and what's next here? What questions do your findings raise?
I've certainly, for us, we thought this was something, this has been a topic of high importance and interest to the general public, and this is very early research for us, mm-hmm. this particular finding, exploratory, but we thought this was interesting and enough or important enough that we thought we'd get this out there, these preliminary findings. But we're certainly looking to find ways to develop courses, for example, on campus to train our students to better detect propaganda campaigns, right. Kind of distinguish between kind of truth and falsehood and conspiracy and fact.
Well, if it's not just limited to the realm of politics, but we have GMOs, I mean, it can be anything then, right? Anything that divides us may be taken advantage of by a foreign power in social media.
Absolutely.
So that's the reason that we're interested to create a class that the general freshman-level class in media literacy and critical thinking to look at authoritative sources and falsehoods and deceptions, teach people how to find things that are based on bias and what the difference is between opinion and fact.
Okay. Carolyn Lawrence Dill and Sean Dorius of Iowa State University on how Russia is trying to influence America's attitudes about genetically engineered crops and biotechnology. Thanks for this important work. We look forward perhaps to a follow-up. Thank you, Sean and Carolyn.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up in just a moment after a short break, I'll talk with Des Moines Register reporter Lynn Ta on more than a dozen copycat threats at Iowa schools since the Florida shooting. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
Thanks for stopping by. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, as I look at my screen, what's a headline I see? This morning, two killed at Central Michigan University. Gunman armed and dangerous, still at large. Shootings, mass shootings, almost a part of our daily news feed here. And it's been just over 2 weeks since that mass shooting in Florida that killed 17. In that time, school districts and police departments here in Iowa have experienced a rash of apparent copycat threats towards schools here in Iowa. Lynn Taw is reporting on this for the Des Moines Register. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, how's it going?
It's going well. So you've looked into this. How many of these, unless we'll just broadly say copycat, I know there are differences in these two. How many have you been tracing here?
Yeah, so in just a little over the last 2 weeks, here in Iowa, we've been able to record at least 13 threats that have been made towards schools. And those threats are those that kind of reach a level that causes either a lockdown or an evacuation or some sort of interaction with police.
Mm-hmm. So can you give us a sense of what kind of threats have been made here in Iowa? Are they over social media or all kinds of threats?
So actually, the wide majority of those that we're seeing are over social media. So one just that happened maybe about a week ago occurred in Council Bluffs, where a 12-year-old girl made a Snapchat threat towards her middle school, saying that she was planning to bring a weapon and kill everybody. Another threat that we had at Anamosa High School, which was kind of the first ones since the Florida shooting, was a bomb threat. So there's been a wide range of different types of threats. Some students have left messages in their schools. Some have been through Facebook that have been identified. Others are, people who have been concerned and have called police. Mm-hmm. So we're seeing kind of a wide range of threats.
Now, how have police and schools been reacting? Have they been, in light of the high-profile Florida shooting, is this a case, do you get the feeling of authorities reacting where they wouldn't have before, wanting to make sure that they assume that every threat is credible now, right?
Right. So police response to school threats have had to dramatically change, even just in the last 10 years. And also, it's different now than what it was before Columbine. So particularly with the Florida shooting, police just can't take any chances, no matter how mm-hmm. small the threat, whether the student, later said, hey, actually, I was just trying to make a joke on social media, didn't mean that. But still, they have to go and thoroughly investigate every single threat because they don't want to be the next, city that ends up in the national news. And so we've also been seeing that takes up a fair amount of police resources because they have to do a thorough investigation, interviews, and make sure that none of these threats are credible.
Do I remember from your reporting, Lynn, that 90-some percent of these threats are turn out to be nothing really to worry about?
Right. So the majority of these students who are making these copycat threats, they may be seeing kind of on the national news, all this attention to the shooting and to the shooter. And so they may also be, feeling that they are wanting maybe some sort of type of attention as well. But even if they're making these threats, oftentimes they don't actually want to commit an act of violence towards their school. But even that negative attention of saying that threat kind of brings that attention to them.
Mm-hmm. And Lynn, are we seeing the same sort of spike in these type of threats in other states as well?
Yeah, so it's actually it's a phenomenon that's being seen across the country, and we're usually seeing an increase in school threats after any kind of high-profile shooting. So the Educators Safety Network, a nonprofit organization that kind of records this data, they have reported that so far there's been at least 600 threats that have been made nationwide. Over the fall, they recorded that on a daily average there were about 10 threats, but since February 15th, that's nearly 80 threats a day.
Wow. quickly before we have to go, Lynn, are authorities talking about how to curb such threats, school authorities?
Yeah, you know, so it kind of goes back to, you know, parents kind of paying attention to kind of the emotions and the actions of their kids, paying attention to their social media. Are they feeling kind of disengaged or disconnected? The other thing, too, is that, you know, they've been talking about providing more training towards teachers who are able to kind of assess, you know, the threat assessment of students in their classrooms, whether they may be feeling more disconnected or acting out, and seeing if there's any signs.
Okay, thank you very much, Lynn Taw of the Des Moines Register, reporting on the rash of apparent copycat threats towards schools here in Iowa. Lynn, thanks so much.
Yep, thank you.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Sad news this week. Dan Miller, the former executive director, general manager of Iowa Public Television, died. He was 66 years old. Joining me now to remember Dan Miller and talk about his leadership, his legacy for us here in the Iowa community, Dean Borg, Iowa Public Radio correspondent. Dean, were a longtime friend of Dan Miller, very close friend of his, and very sorry for your loss of your friend.
It is a big personal loss, Ben, but the bigger loss, even though mine is enormous, I feel, is to the state of Iowa and to public television, not only Iowa Public Television, but PBS, the entire nation's PBS system. He was a leader.
Okay, so tell us a little bit about when we enjoy PBS, Iowa Public Television, now and in years to come. What parts of that and what part of that formation can we thank Dan Miller for?
I think other than the very foundation of Iowa Public Television, because there were executive directors before him, but Dan, and I've spent more than 45 years with Iowa Public Television, so I saw the evolution from when it was just Channel 11 in Des Moines to now the statewide network, and I've seen Dan Miller's influence on that in the middle of that. Mm-hmm. And it's just been enormous because during his career, digital, high-definition television came in. And I remember Dan saying to me, "Dean, we're going to have the ability to transmit multiple channels. We can have our main channel, but we can also have .1, .2, .3. And where are we going to get that content?" But he mastered it. And he mastered the enhancement of existing programs. Iowa Press was already there maybe about 4 years old when Dan first came on staff, but Dan took it like it was his child, and he nurtured that program to where it is today as a very prominent public affairs program in Iowa, market to market the same way. And I could name others in new programs that have come online.
Mm-hmm. Dan Miller worked for IPTV for 38 years, the last 10 years as general manager. We have a little bit of audio from our archive of Dan Miller. This is a man who wasn't a lot in front of the camera or in front of the microphone, right, before we go back to this archive footage.
Yes, because when you asked me, Ben, what might we remember of Iowa Public Television as Dan's legacy, you won't remember him on the air. He was not an air personality. He was the brains and the catalyst behind what you saw on the air.
Okay, so nevertheless, let's go back to listen to a little bit of Dan Miller early in his career in this archive.
Convention coverage team, Dan Miller, who was up very late last night covering a district caucus. And Dan, you've been able to assess, even though you were at 1 until about 4:30 this morning, I think it was, and then worked until about 7 o'clock this morning, up all night. You have been able to assess what happened at all the district caucuses, and I'd like to have you give us that report now.
I've assessed it as well as can be determined, Dean. As you mentioned, and Dr. Ross, I think, mentioned, the caucuses reflected the closeness of the race that we have continuing today. The delegates gathered about 8:30 last evening, both here at Veterans Auditorium and in hotels across the city, for what proved to be a very long and hard-fought event. It was, as we saw during the Democratic Convention, politics at its best. Before the caucuses were called to order, which itself took some time, delegates occupied themselves by counting and recounting the heads of supporters, arguing and lobbying. That was to be expected.
Dean, we heard Dan Miller earlier in his career. Talk a little bit about the backgrounds. And you knew Dan for decades, about how he was in the younger years and why he was so passionate about this career path.
Well, Ben, I didn't know this when I first met Dan. I first saw Dan in 1975 after I'd been working on the Iowa Press program for, about 4 or 5 years up to that time. And all of a sudden, I was introduced to this skinny young man who looked like he was barely out of high school, still an adolescent with acne on his face. And I met this Dan Miller, but quickly began to respect him for the way that he dedicated himself to excellence and the integrity that he had. And he soon proved himself. He moved up through the ranks to be program director and then eventually executive director. You might like to know that I initially, in journalism, worked with Dan's father, Marty Miller. He was a wire service journalist, and I worked with him as I was a student at then Iowa State College. And I worked with his dad, Marty Miller, as a wire service correspondent.
Mm-hmm. Dan Miller, 66 years old when he died a few days ago. He battled for many years up to his death, multiple system atrophy. This is a rare disease that is described as Parkinson's on speed?
That's the way it's described, and I guess I saw a part of that because early on I didn't know that Dan was suffering some symptoms, experiencing some symptoms. But he called me one day and he said, Dean, I need some help. I was then also working at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, and he thought that perhaps I would have some insight into a specialist that he could see at the University of Iowa. And I did. I got an appointment there, but I remember Dan saying, Dean, I want to describe for you what I'm up against, and he described his symptoms. Well, Ben, to make it short, from the University of Iowa, he was referred on to Chicago. Then I think he and his wife, Diane, I believe there may have been some other cities involved, but eventually ended at the Mayo Clinic. And always it was a Parkinson's diagnosis, because this disease called multiple system atrophy has been described, as you say, Parkinson's on speed. And it just eventually crippled Dan, and even in his speech.
Mm-hmm. Do you have another story about Dan Miller that you can leave us with as we come to the end of this conversation that can really illustrate, perhaps for someone who never met Dan Miller, the sort of guy he was?
Well, I do many, many stories, of course, but Dan was always very dedicated, but maybe if we go to stories, I don't know that anything would exactly illustrate this, Ben, but his legacy is integrity. There was no compromising with integrity, editorial integrity with Dan Miller. He vigorously defended the independence of Iowa Public Television against any inroad by government officials or anything like that, trying to control programming or influence with special guests, things like that. He vigorously defended that. He also vigorously enforced editorial integrity among those people who are on the air. He didn't want any equivocation, I guess is a good word. He didn't want any equivocation. In fact, one of his favorite phrases was, perception, Dean, is reality. What people think they might see, they actually believe is true. Well, you may think that you don't have any outside influence. Viewers may, and I don't ever want that at Iowa Public Television.
Mm. On the personal side, this is a painful time for you, and you know, But I wonder if you could leave us with a personal memory of Dan Miller as a friend.
Well, Dan was a confidant of mine. I depended on Dan always for critique. And Dan and I were close enough friends that we could speak frankly. And Dan didn't mince any words when something that I had done on the air he thought could have been done better. And so I valued that. I called Dan oftentimes after a program and said, Dan, what do you think? And he would give me his frank opinion. Ben, after he resigned from Iowa Public Television, I didn't want to give that up. And I had called Dan very soon after he had left as executive director because of health reasons, and I sought some advice. And his response was, Dean, I don't work there anymore. But what Dan was saying, and that was his life, he did not want to interfere with the current administration and the new people at Iowa Public Television who had replaced him. He was not Dan Miller of Iowa Public Television anymore. He was saying to me, I've given you all that I can, and now you're going to have to listen to somebody else.
Dean Borg, thank you for helping us remember Dan Miller. Dean Borg, longtime friend, close friend of Dan Miller, former executive director, general manager of Iowa Public Television. He died at the age of 66. Dean Borg, thank you for sharing professional and personal memories of Dan Miller.
Thank you, Ben.
Also, thanks to IPTV for the archive sound in our remembrance of Dan Miller. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Almost to a close, but we want to talk about rankings and lists. Oh, we love those rankings and those lists. They attract so much attention also on the internet, in our news biz, for sure. Well, this week we heard Iowa is the best state in the country. Yes, our state, the best state in the country, according to the second annual 2018 Best States Study. This is from U.S. News and World Report. Let's see, another ranking that came out recently, not so flattering to our state. The Iowa Business Council's competitive dashboard ranking the state's demographics and diversity as poor. And we have another one, a new report from the American Lung Association in our news. Iowa ranks low nationally for early detection and survival of lung cancer. We love our lists, as I said. Kyle Munson is with us. He's Iowa columnist at the Des Moines Register. Just a couple minutes here, Kyle, to talk about this. I'm scratching my head. Hey, we live in the best state in the country. That's a good thing.
That's right. Yeah. Hey, Ben. Good to talk to you. You know, I guess if our Iowa humility will let us brag, you know, we can and say, you know, in your face, Minnesota and Nebraska.
Right. It's
and
not nothing. Else. It's nothing we didn't know already, though.
That's right.
Hey, but Kyle, so what do you think of our penchant, our love of lists and rankings?
Well, I've always been one, and you know, having been a journalist long enough, you kind of learn that you live by the list, you die by the list, right? Whether you were making a good point here. We have all these competing rankings coming out all the time. But also, if you dig into any one particular list, like such as this new U.S. News and World Report list, you know, you'll see that Iowa fares better or worse depending on the particular metric that, you know, generated the overall top line stats. So, yeah, be careful how much you really brag on
and list. Yeah, and you'd agree, be careful of the source, because a lot of these lists, these rankings, are just clickbait to get you there for some other reason, get your attention for another reason.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, people, the different firms put out the lists for a variety of motivations. But, you know, to be fair, U.S. News and World Report, they have been in the ranking business for quite some time, and people do pay attention to that. And, you know, the governor was on CBS Morning News. So it's something that people obviously really paid attention to this week, and here we are talking about it. And there are some good, there is some good news in the list for Iowa, but you dig down and you see that, you know, we still are sort of exporting our young educated people, and we're having a hard time holding on to the younger population. Entrepreneurship, we still rank pretty low. So there are a lot of different things within there that speak to some of the challenges that we keep talking about month after month.
Right. Kyle, we have to go, but I'm working on a list. I hope you'll help me with it. It's going to be like the top 10 of lists of things you overhear on RAGBRAI. I've got car up, car back, and third on my list is, where's the next craft beer tent?
That's right, yeah. And we're like, oh, stop, quick stop, there's some pie.
You know? There you go. Okay, Kyle Munson, thanks so much.
Thanks, Ben.
And to finish up our News Buzz edition, well, this year's first 8035 Musical Festival lineup announcement came out this week in Cedar Falls. Tony Daner is there, Iowa Public Radio production assistant. Also, of course, Studio One host. Hi, Tony. We don't have much time.
Hey, Ben, no problem.
Tell us. It's a first in the festival's 11-year history. What's the first?
Well, for the first time, the festival is going to have two female headliners. And this is not just an 8035, you know, issue or whatever you want to call it. You know, music festivals have been not been big on bringing in female artists just in general. And a lot of articles have been written about this, and social media users, musicians, and festival goers very willing to call out festivals for not having a very diverse lineup when it comes to gender or any other, really.
Okay, coming up on our time, who do we have headlining?
We've got Kesha headlining, a big mainstream pop singer, just brought down the house at the Grammys not too long ago, and Fantagram, a duo from Greenwich, New York. Sarah Barthel, the singer for Fantagram, she's great. And also performing, not headlining, but Courtney Barnett, who we're a big fan of here at Studio One. She's got a new album coming in May, had a great album last year with Kurt Vile. And we're really looking forward to her. Also announced already, Atmosphere and Car Seat Headrest.
Okay, very good. Thanks, Tony Daner in Cedar Falls. Let's
Thanks,
go
Ben.
Out with a little of a Courtney Barnett's song, Nameless and Faceless, in her upcoming album. She'll be featured at the 8035 Music Festival coming up this summer in Des Moines. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Ben Stanton, and Lindsay Moon. Help today also from Natalia Reyes and Sean McClain in Ames. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us, and have a great weekend.